The moon is nearly 240,000 miles away. But more people have walked on its surface than have been to the greatest depths of our oceans. Only two people have descended into the deepest part of the Marianas Trench, the deepest known point in the ocean, and that was a half a century ago. And they didn't even get out. They just stopped right on through. So people didn't start thinking seriously about the deep sea until the middle of the 19th century. They used technologies adapted from fishermen and navigators to probe the depths. But scientists couldn't hope to understand much about that mysterious environment using simple nets and lines. 75 years ago this summer, Otis Barton and William Beebe took ocean exploration to new depths with the bathysphere. What have people throughout history hoped to learn from the deep sea? And why does it remain a mystery to us still? Well, we've got some people who can help answer that question. Helen Rozwadowski is author of the book Fathoming the Ocean, The Discovery and Exploration of the Deep Sea. She's also assistant professor of history and coordinator of maritime studies at the University of Connecticut, Avery Point, and she joins us today by phone. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rozwadowski.
Hi, thanks.
Good. And also joining us to talk about Barton and Beebe's historic dives is Brad Mattson, author of the book Descent, The Heroic Discovery of the Abyss. And he joins us today from our New York studio, NPR studio in New York. Welcome to the show, Mr. Mattson.
Thanks very much for having me, Joe.
Well, it's great to have you both here. And Dr. Rozwadowski, your book kind of looks back at some really interesting history of the deep and the oceans. And I wonder, maybe we could start by talking about what the deep was considered to be in the 1850s. Not exactly the same as we think of it today.
Right. In fact, for a long time, even in the late 18th and early 19th century, there were people who thought that there was no bottom to the ocean or that we could never find out what the bottom of the ocean would be. And then when people started talking about exploring the deep sea, initially they meant a couple of tens of fathoms down. A fathom is 6 feet, or the length of a grown man's wingspan from tip to tip, if you will, fingertip to fingertip. So what counted as deep changed over the 19th century, but by the mid-19th century, people were fascinated by the deep sea, both as a place and as an idea.
And who were the first people to actually, start thinking about this in a systematic way?
Well, there were different groups of people asking their own sets of questions who finally, eventually, toward the end of the 19th century, came together. There were naturalists, people interested in marine critters and seaweeds and things like that. There were hydrographers who were essentially surveyors, people who made charts, engineers, people who made instruments. Instrumentation technology has always been a big part of the story of deep sea exploration because we can't go there and we can't see it even without the mediation of technology. So a lot of different groups were interested. And then the other groups that were interested were people who were interested more, as I was saying, in the idea of the ocean, the kind of the romantics, the maritime novelists, people interested in testing themselves against nature and going to sea for lots of different personal, economic, psychological reasons.
We're talking with Helen Rozwadowski about her new book, Fathoming the Ocean, The Discovery and Exploration of the Deep Sea, and Brad Mattson, the author of Descent, the heroic discovery of the abyss. And we'd like to have you join the conversation, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And Dr. Rozwadowski, before I get to Brad Mattson, I just wanted to ask you, what were some of the first technologies that were used in studying the ocean? I guess the first question was, how deep is it?
How deep is the ocean?
Yeah.
Well, the first technologies, I'll answer that first, were commercial technologies. On the side of the naturalists, it was an oyster dredge, an industrial tool that was kind of made over in a couple of ways, including making it foldable so it could be put in the bottom of a suitcase. That was an important innovation in the technology of deep sea initial deep sea study. And then on the hydrographic side, which is really sort of how deep is the ocean, the first sounding technology was the sounding technology you can still read about today in Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi. It's a lead and line. And the first deep sea sounding technologies were not much more complicated. They experimented with different kinds of line, different weights of sinkers to make the line sink to the bottom, and detaching mechanisms to send more weight down and bring less weight up. But pretty simple technology. What turned out to be the tricky part was the technique. And when hydrographers first started measuring the depth of the ocean, the first few measurements they got, which they were pretty sure were right, suggested that the ocean was 7 or 8 miles deep, up to 2 miles deeper than the highest mountain is tall. And that was a very surprising result because they expected the bottom of the ocean to be about as deep as the tallest mountain was high, a sort of sense of proportion. It turns out those measurements were wrong, but it really influenced the initial impression of the deep ocean as a kind of violent, rough, wild place.
Well, let's scroll forward about 75 years in time and talk to Brad Mattson about these two gentlemen, Otis Barton and William Beebe, who kind of were an odd couple, but they came together to design and build and then operate this thing called the Bathysphere. What was that, and what was it intended to do?
Well, Joe, the Bathysphere was basically a sphere cast out of steel, paid for by Otis Barton, and in it he and William Beebe made dives to the greatest depths was about 3,000 feet. And nothing like this had ever been done before. In fact, no humans had ever descended beyond sunlight until they did it.
And what was there? Were they adventure seekers? Were they scientists? What were their goals?
As Dr. Rozwadowski mentioned, the confluence of technology was enormous, and these men happened to intersect with Bessemer steel, which was hard enough to withstand the pressure of the deep, with quartz glass and with certain kinds of cables that would allow them to stay safe on their dive and to get some electricity down so they could look out the window. There isn't much point in going down there unless you look outside. William Beebe was arguably the most famous naturalist and science popularizer of his time, he was well known. He had published 15 books by the time he went down in the Bathysphere. Otis Barton was an adventurer, a young man with a very large trust fund, and he paid the bills. And they met in 1928, and 2 years later they made their first dive off Bermuda into the Atlantic Ocean to a depth of 800 feet. And it was frightening. This is not a book for the claustrophobic, and it's not a story for the claustrophobic. Crawling into a 4.5-foot steel ball, two people, it really looks about like there's room for a large dog inside. And they went inside with tanks of oxygen so they could breathe and open trays of chemicals to absorb the moisture and the carbon dioxide, which, of course, everybody knows about since Apollo 13. But this craft that these men were diving in was the equivalent of a spacecraft. And when I first came across it, it was under the roller coaster in Coney Island outdoor storage yard.
What was it doing there? That's such an amazing story. Maybe you could just tell that to...
Oh, sure. With all due respect to the Wildlife Conservation Society, the institutional descendant of the New York Zoological Society, with which Beebe was affiliated his entire life, they had taken it off display, and since it's made of steel and it had been to the depths of the ocean, you know, it could sit out in the rain a little bit, and they had it in an outdoor storage yard. And I was working on the story, and I lost track of these guys in the 50s, or I lost track of the Bathysphere itself in the 1950s. And I asked my daughter, Laura, to see if she could poke around New York a little bit and find out where this thing was. And she called me very excited and said, "Oh, Dad, you won't believe this, but I found the thing under the roller coaster in Coney Island." So I rushed right out there, and sure enough, there it was. And it was magnificent. It was really just like coming across an Apollo spacecraft in a flea market, basically. Wow. And the people at the Wildlife Conservation Society were very, very helpful to me. They provided photographs and archives. And so when I was preparing my manuscript for publication, I submitted it to them. They had a look at it. And when I'm in New York, I live in Chelsea, which is about 10 miles south of the Bronx, where the Zoological Society is. But when they read the manuscript in which I give an account of finding the Bathysphere under the roller coaster, you could hear the jaws drop way down in Chelsea. I mean, they said, "What is that thing doing there?" So now the Bathysphere is back on display. As of the anniversary of the 75th anniversary, we had a big celebration out there and put it back on display. So that's quite wonderful
news,
really.
So it's up at the Bronx Zoo now?
No, it's actually at the New York Aquarium out of Coney Island.
Excellent.
They moved it only about 100 meters, actually, over to a display area.
Excellent. All right. Well, I have to go. I have to go check that out next time in New York. But I'd like to invite our listeners to put in their questions. 800-989-8255. I know that doesn't really talk about the history of the bathysphere so much, but it's such an amazing story. I thought we had to get to it. Let's talk to Troy in Salt Lake City, Utah. Troy, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. I just wondered what kind of an influence the novel Moby Dick had on ocean exploration.
Interesting. Dr. Roswedowski, I think you might have something to say about that.
I do, a huge influence. Moby Dick, Melville's writings, and maritime novels in general were part of a very strong wave, pardon the pun, of popular interest in the ocean, and also representative of a new kind of person who was going to sea in the mid-19th century. Before the 19th century, you would only have gone to sea if you had to, if you were a sailor, if you were a career naval officer, a colonial official being sent somewhere. But what was different in the mid-19th century was that you had middle-class, educated landlubbers who would go to sea because they were pretty sure they would come back. It was a lot safer to go to sea. And you start getting people like Melville, like Richard Henry Dana, going to sea and writing about the experience of having been at sea. And that was a huge part of the development of scientific and cultural interest in the ocean. In other words, the development of scientific interest in the ocean was tremendously fueled by the development of the reading public's interest in reading about the ocean. And another novel to keep in mind, Moby Dick was important, so was Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That was tremendously important. That was about the deep ocean, and that was published in the 1860s for the first time.
Troy, thanks very much for that question.
Thank you very much.
I just wondered, would deep sea research, I mean, this was a gentlemanly or gentle lady interest in this world and perhaps from a few novelists, but would the world of deep sea exploration really have taken off without the commercial interest in laying telegraph cables because suddenly it became important to know what was down there?
It probably would not have received as much funding and attention if it wasn't for the submarine telegraph industry. But the initial exploration of the deep ocean by hydrographers was undertaken because of the huge expansion of shipping in the first half of the 19th century, which was a product of industrialization. But so was submarine telegraphy. And the idea of being able to communicate instantaneously across the ocean was fascinating to people, was politically something that was very interesting to government leaders and to entrepreneurs. So there was a lot of motive. But you might be surprised, actually. There were only a couple of one real survey all the way across the Atlantic, and the first set of cable-laying efforts were made in the 1850s, and the cable was laid successfully in 1858 and worked for a month. And then it took a while because of the Civil War to gain momentum again for another set of cable-laying attempts. And there were no surveys, very few surveys, a little bit of detail work near the coast before the second set of submarine telegraph cables. So there was a great deal of interest in the ocean, but people were pretty easily convinced that they figured out how to lay cables in the ocean and that the telegraph plateau, as they called it, the place where they discovered would be the right place to put the cable, was a safe place to put cables.
We're talking with Helen Roswedowski, the author of the book Fathoming the Ocean, and Brad Mattson, the author of another book called Descent, both about exploring under the ocean. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're interested in hearing your questions about the deep ocean. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The other thing that interests me in your book, Dr. Roswedowski, was the unwillingness of some scientists to listen to what the whalers had to say, because they had learned a lot about the ocean from just experience.
Right, and this was a broader issue in the professionalization of science. It didn't only happen in ocean science. But in this case, there were fishermen and whalers who were learning a lot about the ocean, and sperm whalers in particular were learning a lot about parts of the ocean that no one else had visited, because sperm whales, right whales, which are the species that had been hunted commercially first, stay relatively close to shore. But when whalers had decimated those populations and put triworks on vessels, they headed to the South Atlantic, they headed to the Pacific.
I'm sorry, triworks? What are those?
Oh, I'm sorry. I
dipped into jargon.
Triworks are a furnace on board a ship to render the blubber into oil.
Uh-huh.
So you don't have to take the whale back to shore to do that.
I got it.
So when you think about the kind of high days of the American whaling industry, you think of these 4 and 5 year voyages that where these ships were essentially like the factory ships that were out there fishing in the 1950s and 60s that caught so many of the commercial fish in that era. So the sort of floating factory arrangement, these whalers were the first people in most parts of the Pacific, many parts of the Antarctic, and they were really the ones noticing that how deep sperm whales dove, for example. So when scientists started asking themselves whether life could exist at great depths, whalers were sort of out there saying, well, of course it can, how deep these whales dive. And not all scientists were willing to take the word of whalers and fishermen, but some of them were, and those points of crossover were some of the points where that knowledge got transferred into the scientific literature.
Right. Brad Mattson, I wonder if I can just ask you briefly, when these two explorers went down in the bathysphere, did they learn anything interesting from a scientific point of view?
They were the first people to observe the deterioration of light, for one thing, which was quite interesting, and Beebe took that very seriously. And then, of course, they looked outside and they saw animals that no one had ever seen before that had evolved in total darkness, which means that they had, in order to do the two things which life has to do on this planet, which is get a meal and get a date, they had to grow lights on their bodies. They had to figure out some way to attract other animals in total darkness. So they were able to look out the window beyond about 1,500 feet, it's pitch black, and see what was there. They contributed immensely to this romanticizing of the ocean because they were front page news on papers all around the world. They were celebrities as big as rock stars, and so all of a sudden we've got these two guys sealed in a steel ball on the end of a cable off Bermuda on the front page of the paper, and the ocean is becoming an entirely different place with every report from Bermuda. It's really quite wonderful.
Well, we're going to come and talk. We're going to talk more about that and actually talk to someone who's had an experience of going down to the bottom. But we have to take a short break. So we'll be back in a minute or two. Stay with us. We're talking this hour about exploring the deep ocean, and my guests are Helen Rozwadowski, author of the book Fathoming the Ocean, The Discovery and Exploration of the Deep Sea, and Brad Mattson, author of the book Descent, The Heroic Discovery of the Abyss. And now joining us by phone from Thailand is someone who's been down in Alvin, which I guess is the most advanced successor to the bathysphere that Beebe and Barton went down in. Craig Carey is a professor of marine studies at the University of Delaware in Lewis and director of the Center for Marine Environmental Genomics. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Carey, and thanks for staying up so late. I gather it's middle of the night in Thailand.
Yeah, hey, Joe. It's about 3:15 in the morning, and
well,
I appreciate you having me on.
You're very kind to break up your night, or maybe you're just getting in, I don't know. But before we get started, I wanted to play a clip from the last time you appeared on Science Friday, because it was really a remarkable occasion. I think we heard from you from the bottom, so go ahead, let's hear that.
Right now, we're sitting on the bottom in front of a large smoker. This is one of these large chimneys. The chimney is about 15 to 20 feet high. They're made up of basically minerals of sulfur and metals, the pyrite. The top temperature coming out the top of the chimney is about 365 degrees Celsius, and it's billowing this black smoke that comes pouring out the top, often sort of obstructing our view.
Do you remember where you were when you recorded that for us, or recorded that with us?
Oh yeah, very well. It's a site on the East Pacific Rise, just about 1,200 miles off the coast of Costa Rica. We're about 2,500 meters in depth, about a mile and a half, and it was a smoker that we call M-Vent at the site at 9 degrees north.
So can you describe what it's like to go down in a submersible like Alvin?
It's an amazing experience. I think that even after over 35 dives, every time I go down, it's equally as exciting. There's always the anticipation of getting locked into a 6-foot diameter sphere for 9 hours. So initially, when they close that lid, you can have that sort of little bit of apprehension. But the crew that operate the submersible are highly professional and have had tremendous success over the years that Alvin's been operational. And it's a long time in the sphere. It's tiring. It's totally exhilarating. It takes all of your senses. You're exhausted when you come back up to the surface, mostly because you've been working almost round the clock as you've been down there, collecting samples and making observations and recording data.
So I don't know if you describe Alvin's 6-foot in diameter. I don't know if you heard Brad Mattson earlier say that the bathysphere, which we've been talking about this hour, was what Brad Mattson was 4.5 feet.
It was 4.5 feet.
So imagine getting into something like that? And do you think these guys were brave or foolish?
No, extremely brave.
Okay.
But I can't imagine a 4-foot sphere. I mean, with 6 feet, we're cramped in there because of, with all the life support system that's in there and the communications equipment and everything else, we're crammed in there and literally lying on top of each other. So I can't imagine with two feet less diameter, it must have been just an amazingly tight space for them to operate in.
And Joe and Dr. Carey, if I can interrupt.
Sure, go ahead.
Because Joe was broadcasting from the depths, and so did William Beebe and Otis Barton. They made the first broadcast from between 1,500 feet and 2,200 feet from the bathysphere over the NBC radio network in 1932.
So that was a live broadcast from Bermuda?
It was the very first field science live broadcast in the history of the world.
So. Wow. And we thought we had an original idea, I guess. There's probably nothing actually new under the sun. Dr. Carey, I mean, what improvements? I mean, I'm sure there's been a vast number, but what are the major improvements that Alvin has over something like the bathysphere?
Well, I mean, obviously, one thing that Alvin has over the bathysphere is it's untethered. It's a free vehicle, so it's able to move away from the mothership and move into kind of the nooks and crannies on the seafloor and operate at multiple angles very, very, very carefully and precisely. And I think that's what makes a sort of a manned submersible as opposed to, say, an ROV essential.
An ROV?
Yeah, the ROVs are the remotely operated vehicles. There's a movement globally to incorporate unmanned sort of remote operated vehicles to replace manned submersibles, or at least to take up some of the slack on the manned submersibles. Obviously, the advantage of a remotely operated vehicle is that you've got 24-hour presence on the seafloor. As opposed to Alvin, which can only be down for 9 hours or so. And so, but there's a lot of us who believe that it's essential that we still visit the seafloor and that we get down there, because there's a lot of things that we do on the seafloor that we don't believe that the ROVs are capable of doing.
And I gather that Alvin is being retired, is that right?
Alvin's over 35 years old and has had a remarkable career. In fact, I would say that it's probably the most successful submersible ever globally ever built in terms of the number of dives per year that Alvin has done and the length of time it's been in service. There's been a lot of improvements made both in, obviously in the material science area of the field as well as in electronics. That sort of now sort of mandate that we need to develop and build a new submersible to accommodate some of the new needs of science that we're doing on the seafloor.
Okay, let's see if we can get some of our callers to join in this really interesting conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Phil in Burke, South Dakota. Phil, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question for any of your guests today, whether they are cooperating with NASA on any missions to Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter, and believed to have a deep ocean, which is covered by an ice shell. I just wonder if any of your guests know about that or know of any missions or are cooperating with NASA on that.
Sort of a different kind of a challenge, but let's ask, Phil. Thanks for the question.
You're welcome.
Anybody care to take a stab at that?
Well, this is Craig Carey.
Craig Carey, uh-huh.
I'll take a stab. I mean, certainly I'm very aware, and I think anybody who's been working in and around hydrothermal vents very aware of the current sort of theories and speculation on Europa. NASA has been working with us in hydrothermal vent areas over the past 10 years or so. I've been working with several NASA engineers and NASA scientists, and I think what NASA's real interest is to try to figure out exactly what they need to do and what they need to build in order to access the possibility of accessing hydrothermal systems on Europa. I mean, the theory is that below this very thick ice surface of Europa, that there's liquid water, and if there's liquid water there, then there has to be something that's maintaining it liquid. If you take a look at Io, the nearest moon to Europa and the closest moon to Jupiter, it's a very volcanic. I think it's said to be the most volcanic feature in the solar system. And Europa is frozen, so it's believed that maybe Europa has hydrothermal features associated with it that's keeping it liquid water. The difficulty, of course, is that there's a huge chunk of ice on the surface that they need to get through, kilometers of ice that they need to get through. And I know that there's a lot of work that's going on right now at NASA to try to devise the technology to access that.
Interesting.
And once they break through, hopefully those of us who have been working in vents over the last 20 years will be sort of brought into the network at NASA so that we can help them begin to explore these features.
Of course, I guess, as you say, if you did get as far as Europa, you'd still have to get through the top layer of ice to get down to the bottom to find the vent to see if there was something there. So it's a big challenge, I should think.
That's not a trivial task.
No. Well, as I guess NASA has learned yet again today, getting into space just by itself is pretty tricky. But let's take another call. How about if we go to Sharon in East Hampton, New York? Sharon, welcome to the program.
No, hi. I have two questions. One of them is, can you go online and see any of the pictures from down below? Any place online to see them?
Well, let's take these one at a time. Craig Carey, pictures from Alvin online someplace?
Sure. In fact, we have over the last 5 years, we've developed an interactive web page. If you go to, if it's okay, I'll tell you what the website is. It's www.ocean.udel.
For University of Delaware.
Right.
Oh, okay.
udel.edu/ Extreme 2004. That's one word. Extreme 2004.
Okay.
And if you go to that site, you'll see a legacy of 5 years of video and photographs. It's an interactive site that we've designed over the last 5 years for school kids.
And let me just ask Brad Mattson, any pictures that you know of that are available of the bathysphere?
Really, just probing around the internet, you're going to find all kinds of photographs of the bathysphere. Just enter that word in a search engine of some kind, and you'll find them.
Okay. And Sharon, your second question.
Yeah. Tell me if you know about the involvement of Ed Link in some of this deep sea exploration, because I seem to remember in the 80s that he and his son went down in what I thought was the bathysphere, but maybe it wasn't. And then they unfortunately had some malfunctions, and they never came up. But is he involved? He was the guy who invented the Link trainer.
Right. Okay, interesting.
Aircraft. And I thought he was involved in this, too. I'm not sure.
Okay, Sharon, thanks for that. Brad Mattson, is that something you can shed some light on?
You know, I know who Ed Link was, but I don't know the story of his deep-sea exploration. I know it wasn't a bathysphere because the last bathysphere dove in August of 1934 with William Beebe and Otis Barton in it. Who by this time couldn't stand one another. After they made their last dive, they never spoke to each other again. That's what 4.5 feet will do to you. But I don't know about the Link story. Maybe one of the other guests knows.
Joe, I can maybe chime in a little.
Helen Rozwadowski, go ahead. That'd be great.
My new research project that I've just started working on is on undersea exploration in the 1950s and 60s, so I've been listening to all this with great interest. But Link was one of he was a singular individual, but one of a type of person who was very involved in the technology and made this kind of crossover. The designer of Alvin was this kind of person, too. A lot of people involved in ocean exploration were sort of combinations of scientists and engineers, people who were really good at sort of tinkering and making things better. And he was one of the people who was a pioneer of saturation diving and these things that led to not so much bathyspheres, but undersea habitats. So that's sort of a pretty sketchy answer, but it would be not so much the bathysphere part of the story, but heading toward the kind of Jacques Cousteau conch shell sea lab part of the story, I would think.
Interesting. All right. Well, we're talking this hour about exploring the deep oceans, and we're taking your calls. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Brian in Stevenson, Washington. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I have really enjoyed this topic, and having worked in fisheries and as a scientific technician on the ocean a bit, this is a great topic, and I just wanted to say that this is really the water planet, and we're covered mostly with water, and that I think that the exploration of inner space, or that underwater space where life exists and there is huge amounts of resources, kind of outweighs the benefit of exploring outer space with the same amount of money. And I was interested to think if, or to hear if your guests thought that, tax funding of undersea research is as viable as outer space research.
Well, it's an interesting question, especially as we were talking earlier today about the space station and what it's going through. But Brian, thanks for the call. Craig Carey, maybe I could start with you. You've got more money than you know what to do with, I'm sure.
I don't know if that's the case.
Sorry,
I
was...
I think that that's a really, really good question, and I think that it's one that is a very provocative one. I think that NASA has done a tremendous job at promoting and building its program, and I think that we are very fortunate, I think, in the United States especially, to have a federal agency, the National Science Foundation, that sees it as a priority to continue to support deep sea exploration. I think that there's always, in anybody who works and is passionate about a field, there's always a feeling that there's a need to put more money into this. And there are certainly some very large programs that are currently being developed through the National Science Foundation to continue, not only continue, but to build on what we've already done. The ocean is a big place, and it's a very expensive proposition to go out there and do this type of work. And so, it happens in small pieces. And there is a global and international desire, I think, now to start to coalesce some of the efforts from other countries and bring them together in more collaborative efforts to do larger areas. The new Alvin. And I'm calling it Alvin because it hasn't been given a name yet, but the new submersible that's being built by the United States through the National Science Foundation, I think it will be ready in 2008, I heard, will have a new depth capability of 6,500 meters as opposed to the 4,500-meter depth capability of Alvin, which will give us about 99% of the seafloor capability. So that's opening up a whole new area for us in the ocean, and I think that's going to hopefully bring on a whole bunch of new funding initiatives through the National Science Foundation.
John, well, I'd like to jump in because
Dr. Razvodowsky, very briefly, because we're almost out of time.
One of the things that I've noticed is that culturally, our interest in deep sea exploration, ocean exploration, waxes and wanes, and it was very intense in the mid 19th century. It was very intense again in the 1950s and 60s, and I see another period of very profound interest in the ocean with the U.S. Ocean Commission, the Pew Commission, the decision to fund open-ended exploration of the ocean in the year 2000.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry to have to interrupt you, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guest this hour. Helen Rozwadowski is author of the book Fathoming the Ocean. Brad Mattson is author of the book Descent, The Heroic Abyss, Discovery of the Abyss. And Craig Carey is a professor of marine studies at the University of Delaware. Thanks to all of you for joining me.